Welcome to That Medic Podcast, your bi-weekly dose
of all things digital health, global health, and leadership.
My name is Success, a student at Cambridge University.
And I am Simmer, a student at Harvard University.
Join us as we chat with some top professionals in healthcare. Enjoy.
In this podcast, we spoke to Dr. Lori Zephyrin, Senior Vice President for Advancing Health Equity at the Commonwealth Fund. We discussed why physicians should get involved in policy, how to make real progress on health disparities, and why equity is fundamental to quality. Today's show is perfect for anyone curious about navigating the intersection between medicine and public service, but just intrigued about creating a more just healthcare system. So, without further ado, let's have a listen. Hi, Dr. Zephyrin. Welcome to the show. Thank you so much for taking the time out to speak with me. We normally start the podcast by asking the question, why did you decide to pursue medicine?
Thanks for that question. And thanks so much for having me. I'm so excited to hear about the work that you're doing. And it's so great to be on. In terms of why I decided to pursue medicine, I mean, it may sound corny, but honestly, I wanted to make a difference and have a positive impact on the world. And obviously, there are many ways that we can do that and have that impact. But I realized very early on the impact of social environment and circumstance on health. And I really saw health as a means of doing that. And so, I mean, it must have been in my sophomore year in high school, I decided, like, I want to be a doctor.
Well, that's wonderful. And I know you ultimately earned your medical degree from NYU and then completed your OBGYN residency at the Brigham and Massachusetts General Hospital. You then went on to earning your MBA and MPH at Johns Hopkins. I wanted to ask you why you pursued both these business and public health training and how it's influenced your future career.
Yeah, that's a great question. You know, I'd love to say that I had it perfectly planned. I didn't. I think part of it is being open to opportunities, and medicine and healthcare in our society is really changing on a daily basis. So, like, for example, what you see today is not going to be what's going to be available in 10 years. So part of it's being open to opportunities. And so when I finished, completed residency at Brigham and Mass General, I was really interested in the intersection of policy and public health and medicine. And I was able to go on to Hopkins, and I was actually doing a research slash policy program. It was the RWJ Clinical Scholars Program. And as part of that, we would complete an MPH, learn research skills, do clinical work. And that was just really an amazing opportunity. But then I started to want to better understand the business of medicine and the intersection between public health and business and policy and business, because any solution or intervention required not only policy change, but resources. And I thought, you know, by being able to understand how to make the business case of any public health recommendation or policy recommendation, I felt that that would provide me with more tools to have an impact. And also at the same time, an opportunity presented itself. Hopkins was just starting their MPH MBA program, which it was, I think, one of the first combined MPH MBA programs. So it was fantastic. So part of it was right place, right time, being open to opportunities and also an interest.
That's wonderful. And I think, I mean, it speaks a little bit to the serendipity of people's pathways. It often looks like a linear, well-planned out cycle, but it often is a little bit more meandering, things falling into place at the right time and being open to that.
Right. And I think sometimes that could be frustrating for people because it's like, oh, wow, like you just happen to fall into it. Like it doesn't always happen that way. And it doesn't mean that there aren't ups and downs and challenges, but you know, I think, you know, being open to thinking outside of the box can be helpful.
Certainly. And I think the benefit of having that, as you were saying, business and public health background with the dual degree was that I'm sure it gives you an appreciation for a wide range of stakeholders and how to make change in medicine, because oftentimes that is the difficult part in something so complex as healthcare. And I imagine that served you well when you were a White House fellow in President George W. Bush's administration. I know you were placed in the Department of Veterans Affairs, I wanted to ask you, what was that experience like? And what did it teach you about policy and getting things done?
It was an amazing experience to be a White House fellow. Just one, the camaraderie and the people that were fellows along with me. I learned a lot from them and their experiences. I also learned a lot about the VA healthcare system, as you know, really our national healthcare system in the US. It really gave me a sense of how to provide complete care to a population that may have a range of conditions, and how to approach it from a systems perspective, and really being able to integrate and develop policy sort of at the top, and really think about how to help that trickle down. So it really defined my career in many ways. The year I did the White House Fellowship, it was the year of Hurricane Katrina, which was really just a major event, I think, in our history, in terms of just the devastation and the impact it caused on New Orleans and surrounding areas. And literally, like, my first day, you know, I went with the secretary and the chief of staff, you know, and really just saw New Orleans underwater. Went to Mississippi and saw one of the health clinics completely destroyed, saw how VA was able to mobilize its capacity. Like, there was an operations center to be able to deploy people, you know, nurses, physicians, other healthcare workers to surrounding areas, deploy mobile clinics, deploy really their capacity, and really learned about that year the role of the VA healthcare system in being able to respond to emergencies, not only in terms of serving veterans, but also even more broadly serving the country as well. And so that was just a transformational experience for me, and really showed to me the impact of health and healthcare. You know, I worked very closely with the public health team, the secretary. I mean, it really defined my, you know, really the next stage of my career.
Well, that's wonderful. And I know that you actually returned to the VA later in your career. In 2009, you became the first national director of the Reproductive Health Program at the Department of Veterans Affairs. And you served in that capacity until 2018. Obviously, it's always difficult to be the first and to create a position when one didn't previously exist. I wanted to ask you if you could talk a little bit about that experience and what were some of the challenges you faced and how you overcame them.
You know, it was an amazing experience. You mentioned it would be, you know, it can be hard to create something new, but I love that. I loved being able to, you know, create something that didn't exist before. And so, you know, on the one hand, you know, I'm an entrepreneur, I say, you know, in terms of like building new programs, new systems within organizations that, you know, that may need that transformation. I think it's important to sort of set the stage. You know, the VA healthcare system, right, our largest national healthcare system in the U.S., you know, millions of veterans. And really, at the time, the VA healthcare system was seeing a significant influx of a new cohort of veterans, of women veterans, right, that it previously hadn't seen before in that number, right? So maybe 50 to 80% increase in the number of women veterans. So that really meant significant transformational change across the VA healthcare system. You know, and I could have come in as an OBGYN and said, hey, let's hire more gynecologists or hire more OB or build in OB services. But that wasn't really what the system needed at the time. It was really thinking across the entire healthcare system, what does the experience of providing healthcare, for women veterans, what should that look like? And that meant from, you know, veterans walking into the healthcare system and seeing the clerk at the desk who's welcoming them, that they wouldn't be asked, well, where's your father or where's your husband, when they are the person that served on the front lines, and really being able to provide that acknowledgement and respect and also ensure that the services are there. And so it was really exciting to really think about, well, how do we integrate women's health into emergency services, into primary health care? You know, what does a women's primary health care provider look like? You know, how do you build out the capacity around reproductive health services? So it involved really thinking overall the healthcare system, overall looking at the healthcare system and really thinking about how does this experience vary based on different populations and how do we modify that? So it was a lot of fun. I worked with some amazing people, and we were able, I think, to do a lot of good. And I think a lot of that is continuing today.
Oh, that's wonderful. And just describing the challenges and sort of the obstacles you faced during that period and how you overcame them, it was really fascinating for me. It reminds me of this quote that I heard recently in a class of mine. Dr. Greg Meyer, he was describing how the technical stuff, it's challenging, but it's solvable. The culture and political stuff, that's a little bit more difficult to address.
Yeah, so it's really that's true. It's interesting because I remember during, I think it might have been, I don't remember exactly where I heard it. I might have heard it when I was at Hopkins, but someone had said culture eats curriculum for lunch, right? And it could really be the decider of whether what you're trying to do together with others is successful or not.
Certainly. And you know, that makes me think about leadership, and obviously really strong leadership can help lead culture. I know that you also served as acting deputy undersecretary for health for community care in the VA as well. I wanted to ask you if you could tell me a little bit more about what that role entailed and what your experiences across the VA taught you about leadership.
Yeah, again, that was an amazing opportunity to work with, you know, fantastic, talented people. In that role, it was really focusing in on VA's community care arm, which is the arm of VA that functions as like a payer insurer. You know, billions of dollars of VA's business in terms of provision of health care, you know, the VA acts as an insurer and provides that care. Let's say, I don't know, a veteran in, you know, some part of the country doesn't have access to a cardiologist. It doesn't mean they can't get that care at the VA. It means that the VA will find a provider in the community and reimburse that provider for that care. So it was undergoing major transformation. So again, it was kind of like a mini startup in the VA. And the person that led a lot of that transformation, you know, was Dr. Yahia, who really helped spur a lot of that transformation. And so I came along and again, it was just a really entrepreneur type atmosphere where really thinking how to improve how that care was delivered. And so what was interesting is, you know, as director of reproductive health, you know, some of the services that we provided, like maternity care or infertility services, they weren't providers in the VA, for example, that could provide that care, but we had to contract out that care. So that was done through community care. And so I was able to experience and see a lot of the challenges that women veterans were experiencing in terms of finding the provider they wanted, ensuring the services that they needed. Where did they have access to, like, the full range of prenatal and pregnancy and postpartum care services? And so being able to take those lessons on those and those challenges on a broader scale, really at the top of running all of that aspect of community care, and thinking about where can we have impact. So in terms of what, you know, I learned, I mean, I think translating the complex was really, really important, right? Seeing through pathways that are very difficult and convoluted, I mean, just very complex, and being able to translate that to where change needs to happen. And then really thinking about, like, how do you strategically execute that work, you know, and building programs with measures that lead to action. But also, you can't really forget the people building piece, right? How do you bring people together for a common goal? And I must say, like, people worked, you know, really long, hard hours to accomplish the goal of providing amazing healthcare for veterans, and really just was heartened by the mission driven aspect of this work. And then I think the other piece is also learning and being able to communicate the mission, the vision, and, you know, being able to educate people not only internal to the organization, but also outside as well. So I think those skills were really important, particularly at that level of the organization where things were just very complex.
No, certainly. And I think these are all great lessons for our audience of students. And it really speaks to how in health policy, healthcare, it's knowing where to press and also how hard to press and who to bring with you to press in that particular area to make change. Right. I think this is all fascinating. I also know that you occupy a rare position in some ways as a physician really involved in health policy. As you know, when President Bill Clinton and First Lady Hillary Clinton were developing their healthcare policy plan in 1993, there were around 400 or 500 health policy experts in the room working on various facets of the proposal, and almost no physicians were involved. So we've obviously come some way over the past 30 years, but the core question remains as relevant as ever. Why do you think physicians should get involved in health policy, given that you have the unique position of having worked in the VA?
Yeah, I think it is really critical to have physicians' voices in health policy. What I've found is having the experience of being on the ground and firsthand experiencing some of the opportunities and challenges of the healthcare system is really critical. And being able to provide that perspective, you know, whenever, you know, in terms of the policymaking process, part of making policy is talking to your constituents, talking to the people that'll be impacted by that policy, talking to the people who have expertise. And so in sort of the sausage of policymaking, part of that is bringing the experts into the conversation. And as a physician, one has a unique view of the healthcare system and challenges, as well as other healthcare workers, whether we're talking about nurses, as well as patients. And so it's really critical to bring together a multidisciplinary stakeholder group. You know, as a physician, you know, part of why I have always thought it's interesting to be able to help influence policy and systems changes is by making sure and ensuring that the system works, and that allows physicians, nurses, that allows us to do our jobs better, and then that allows patients to get better care. And so I think there's definitely a unique perspective that can be provided. And I think that applies to ensuring that there's diversity, whether one's talking about racial and gender diversity, ensuring that one is bringing an engaging community. And then once policies are implemented, you need all those stakeholders at the table to say, hey, is this working? Is this right? And just more of a sort of specific example, like at the VA, you know, there are a number of policies that we were able to draft, you know, and develop and implement new policies. And so one of them, for example, was focused on emergency services for women veterans, right? Like to really develop like a playbook to ensure that, you know, every woman veteran coming to the emergency department could have high quality care. And that included like having emergency medicine providers on the ground, a part of making that policy. That included looking at the research and engaging researchers to be able to sort of look at the data and see where some of the gaps are. And even in implementing the policy, being able to understand, okay, what are the pain points? What are the challenges? Is this working? It's not. One needs to really have an engaged group to be able to ensure that what is intended is actually what's happening.
Certainly. And I think what you're saying really speaks to the importance of diversity across various levels. There's the diversity of experiences you bring as a physician, public health expert, business expert with your dual degrees beyond MD. There's the diversity you bring in terms of identity. There's the diversity you bring in terms of stakeholders you bring with the emergency room docs and the patients. And it's all really important to crafting good policy because there's often, as I understand it, uncomfortable side effects when you don't do that kind of work, because you can't know what you don't know what you don't know.
Right, exactly.
Wonderful. So I want to shift a little bit now and talk a little bit about your international work. I know that you've done quite a bit across your career, organizing workshops on HIV education and addressing health systems access for women in East Africa and South Africa. So I was wondering if you could tell me a little bit more about that global health work, how you got involved, and why you find it's important.
Yeah, it is so important to understand that we are part of a global community. And I think sometimes that can be missing in our education here in the US. I mean, I'm a child of immigrants, first generation American. And so it was always clear to me that, you know, we're part of a global community. But when I went to undergrad/med school, one of my mentors was Dr. Jack Geiger. And Dr. Jack Geiger, he essentially was like co-founder of Physicians for Human Rights, really co-founder of the Community Health Center movement, really just a luminary in really thinking about the importance of one's social drivers of health and social circumstances and influencing health. I mean, one of his famous quotes is, you know, he had a patient who didn't have food, so he wrote them a prescription for food because, you know, that's really what they needed at the time. And so having him as a mentor, he learned about the Community Health Center movement, a lot of that when he went to South Africa. And so he was my mentor for a research project. And I was able to, under his mentorship, travel to South Africa for a summer and work in rural KwaZulu-Natal and help with understanding why that community experienced a measles epidemic the year prior. And I was traveling, you know, with a nurse. I lived in the nurses' houses. I actually went with another medical student, a colleague who's still a friend. And we went with the nurses and traveled from hut to hut across the mountainside, talking to women and about why their concerns about vaccinating their children. And to me, it just really opened my eyes to just a broader world. And I saw so many similarities between what was happening in that context in terms of like building trust, providing high quality healthcare, trying to really ensure, you know, how do you ensure that communities are centered in providing health and healthcare? And so I just saw so many similarities between the people and the communities in South Africa and communities in the US, just in terms of what impacts health and what impacts healthcare. So that just blew my mind. And I was like, oh my God, like, you know, I need to like, you know, travel the world and learn more about healthcare and healthcare practices and what we can learn to bring back here and what are things that I can learn to help to bring there. So that really transformed my thinking in many ways.
Wonderful. And, you know, a couple of things that you said stuck out to me and it reminded me of this historical account of the smallpox eradication effort. And really it was centered in South Asia at the time. What was interesting about this effort and really tragic was that you had these WHO epidemiologists, these expatriate epidemiologists descending on South Asia and desperately trying to get every person vaccinated, even beyond their consent. There was one Bangladeshi woman who was starving and she refused to get the vaccine until she was given food. She said that if they didn't care whether or not she died of starvation, why should they care if she got smallpox? And they eventually vaccinated her without her consent, didn't give her any food. So I think, I mean, the reason why that story stuck out to me and why I was remembering it is first what you were saying about if a patient needs food, right? And then you give them the prescription for food about your mentor. And beyond that, it is really about centering the community, as you were saying. It's not about going in and imposing your values and your practices on them forcefully. It takes respect. It takes dignity and doing that work.
Right. And trust is a two-way street. And we always say, oh, they have to trust us, then the communities have to trust us. But, you know, we as a healthcare system, as healthcare providers, have to engender that trust, right? By showing that we are providing the best care, by showing that we can listen, by showing that we respect people's values. Like that's how you develop trust.
Mm-hmm. No, certainly. And I think that provides a really nice linkage into some of your current work. So I wanted to shift to now the fact that you're Senior Vice President for Advancing Health Equity at the Commonwealth Fund. For our listeners who might not know, I was wondering if you'd talk a little bit about what the Commonwealth Fund is.
Sure, happy to. The Commonwealth Fund is a foundation. It's been around for a little over 100 years. It's one of the first foundations started by a woman, Anna Harkness. And so our goal is to really drive, promote a high-performing healthcare system. And what that means is really thinking about how to ensure that communities have universal access to healthcare and have high-quality healthcare. We do research. We fund research to help drive policy change and systems change, health systems change to improve healthcare and focusing in on marginalized communities as well. And so it's really an exciting organization because, you know, we consider ourselves small, but, you know, we try to have an outsized impact on policy. So we think very critically in terms of the research that we support and the research that we do. We think about who are the messengers that we want to share that research with. And those messengers usually can take that research to help inform policy change, I think, in a meaningful way.
Yeah, no, that's really wonderful. And I was curious if you could give us a sense of some of the work you do and some of the projects you've worked on.
Sure. So I'll start more broadly with the Advancing Health Equity Program. It's a fairly new program at the fund. We launched that program a little over 2 years ago. The board and the president at the time committed $15 million plus over 3 years to advance health equity, meaningfully focusing in on racial equity and addressing systemic racism within the healthcare system. And so that work and strategy turned into the Advancing Health Equity Program. We have three focus areas, one around how do we drive equity within the healthcare system, really focusing on anti-racism within the healthcare system. The second is around policy change. How do we drive equity through policy change? And then also really think about how to understand equity impacts of policies. And the third is really around culture change, which I think is extremely challenging. Like how can we drive culture change within the healthcare system, culture change of healthcare professionals to really drive health equity and improve outcomes, particularly for marginalized communities?
No, that makes a lot of sense. And I think we're in a moment where there's an increasing recognition of the need to center equity in healthcare. But there's also, as you know very well, plenty of bold statements and promises with little follow through. And I wanted to get your perspectives and ask you, how should we get out of this trap of tokenizing health equity work and actually make progress on this topic?
That's a great question. You know, I think there's a number of ways that needs to happen. I think the culture change is key. I think really focusing in on, you know, just the data itself without thinking about culture. We won't be as successful. And culture change, I think, is the hardest piece. And what does that look like? You know, part of what we're trying to do is to learn from other cultural movements in terms of like, what are the things that cause really, you know, society to shift, right? In terms of, for example, learning from the civil rights movement or learning from the LGBTQ movement around marriage equality, you know, what were the messages that stuck to really truly create transformational policy change? And so part of the work we're funding is really to have a better understanding of those movements. I also think another important piece around culture change is to really understand and highlight, you know, current culture within healthcare. I think within healthcare, there's a perception that, you know, we're in this bubble. You know, we all go into healthcare to have an impact, to make change because we want to make a difference. And right. And so how can there actually be bias? Because we intentionally wouldn't want to do that. And so there needs to be an understanding of, well, when we're thinking about structural racism and systemic racism, you know, we're talking about things that are built into policies and practice and our societies that subtly or not influence how we perceive certain groups of people. And that really means that we need to be able to understand that. And individually, there's a walk that everyone needs to take to not only recognize, but also determine, you know, how that could potentially be impacting their care. And I think the way we do that is, you know, we point that out through research. We point that out through having structures in place that document, that catalog, that show the inequities. And we create accountability such that it's built into our systems, right? It's, you know, it's okay, you do or don't want to do it, but you actually have to do it. And we have to prove that we're actually changing, transforming healthcare, particularly for marginalized people. It's hard work and it has to be done because ultimately that's why we're all in healthcare, to heal. And part of that healing really means understanding our role in continuing these inequities.
I think that's a really excellent point, that physicians do come to healthcare really to make a difference, right? And it's a challenge when you point out the bias, because some people take that as, oh, you're calling me racist, you're doing this, you're doing that, right? And the real point, as you were describing it, is our goal should be to heal, right? And that should be to heal everyone. I also think sometimes of Michael Porter, and he's a professor at Harvard Business School. His classic equation for healthcare value is increasing quality while decreasing cost. In reality, centering equity may require that we spend more on populations with unmet needs. So I was wondering if you could speak a little bit more to that concern, that quote-unquote trade-off, and share with our audience of students why health equity is worth the investment in their work, in our work generally.
So I think fundamentally one of the failures of the quality movement is to not incorporate equity. You can't have quality without equity, right? And so what... one can turn that around is, are you actually achieving quality without integrating equity? You could say, can you say, oh, well, quality in this population, but not in that population because of these, you know, million other reasons. Like that to me is is not possible. So I can't separate quality from equity. And I think what's been really, important to hear over these last couple of years is to hear so many quality experts and luminaries really, really point that out. Like, wait, we need to incorporate, we have to incorporate equity into quality. So that's sort of my first point in terms of can't separate quality and equity, because then you're not actually achieving quality. In terms of the cost piece, you can flip that in terms of just, you know, the cost of healthcare, like decreased costs for whom? I mean, healthcare is increasingly unaffordable. It's one of the major causes of debt. And so we really have to think about what we're actually providing in terms of health and healthcare, and is it actually improving people's lives, right? And so part of that is really flipping the switch in terms of what is health? What is healthcare? And I think that goes into conversations of really thinking about public health and the drivers of health. And by investing in that, then ultimately where we can create a healthier population, and that ultimately will decrease costs.
That's a really wonderful point. And I think on that note, we're nearly wrapped up with the episode. But before we go, I wanted to ask you for three pieces of advice you have for students interested in a career pathway like yours.
I mean, I think the first advice is, like, my path may not be your path, right? And so, you know, sometimes it's about creating your own path. And I've had a very non-traditional path as an OBGYN. And I think part of it is being open to new opportunities. I'd say one example is, you know, going to the VA to be the first director of reproductive health. There were mentors and advisors who were like, why would you go there? There's like no women veterans there. And, you know, fast forward 5 or 10 years later, like, oh my God, that was an amazing opportunity and role. So part of it is like, know the change you want to achieve and really spend time thinking about that, but then realize that it can come veiled in different ways. It may not be, you know, the perfect place or the you know, around the perfect people that you've envisioned, but you know, it could be the best role for you. So I say be open to opportunities, think outside of the box, and just be present. Enjoy each experience. Like, give your 110% into that role and your life at that moment. Because, you know, when you look back, you just want to say, you know what? I gave it my all. I lived, I learned, and I had impact.
What a great note to end on. Thank you so much, Dr. Zephyrin, for coming onto the podcast.
Thank you. And thanks for taking the time to talk.
Hey everyone, thanks for listening to this podcast. Make sure to subscribe, rate us, and leave a review. You can also head to the description of this podcast to follow us on all social media so that you don't miss out on any of our content.